I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Parallax is you observe an object, you see a change, but that change is not really a change in the object, but just a change in how you relate to the object in your perspective of the object.
Welcome to the testing room of the Parallax Corporation's Division of Human Engineering.
Now please cross the chair. And you will sit down. Make yourself comfortable. And be sure to place each one of your hands on the box on either side of the chair. Making sure that each one of your fingers is on one of the white rectangles. Just sit back. Nothing is required of you except to observe the materials that are presented to you. Be sure to keep your fingers on the box at all times. Alright? Hope you find the test a pleasant experience.
Are we living on a gangster planet? Well, that's the provocative but intriguing claim made by our guest on this edition of Parallax Views, investigative reporter Daniel Hopsicker. Following in the footsteps of the late Gary Webb, the San Jose Mercury News journalist, whose controversial Dark Alliance series attempted to propose a link between the LA crack epidemic and Iran-Contra. Hopsicker, for two decades now, has been digging into what he calls transnational organized crime and its intersection with politics and business. Drug trafficking, the Russian mob, money laundering. It's the stuff that hard-boiled crime and conspiracy thrillers are made of. And yet, I've always kept at least one eye on Hopsicker's work, especially since it dovetails, to some extent or another, with the more mainstream works of figures like academic Alfred P. McCoy, journalist Gretchen Peters, and acclaimed Italian reporter Roberto Saviano on the subject of international drug trafficking in the age of global capitalism. In other words, I think there is something to be gleaned from Daniel Hopsicker. Whether or not we agree on the details or even the bigger picture. But I'll let you, the listener, decide on that. Oh, and by the way, be sure to tune in to the very end of this episode when Daniel provides what I think is one of the most probable explanations for who is behind the Q in QAnon. And now, on to my conversation with Daniel Hopsicker, whose work you can follow at madcowprod.com. That's madcowprod.com. It may be worthwhile to peruse that website while listening to this edition of the show. Welcome to Parallax Views, Daniel Hopsicker.
Hello, GG.
So, Daniel, this has been a long time coming. I've been a fan of your work for some time. You've done reporting on the sort of intersection between international organized crime and politics going back for a long time. Maybe you could tell me and my listeners a little bit about how you got into this stuff. I believe you worked as a reporter at ABC originally, correct? And then moved on from there, right?
Well, I mean, I started out as a child. I was a student at UCLA during the Vietnam War, and was politically active at that time because I thought the Vietnam War was a terrible thing. And then promptly after I got out of school, like, you know, forgot all about it because I was like, you know, all of a sudden making a living in Los Angeles. I did business news. I did new product introductions for companies. It was advertising, and then moved into, I finally did a business news show. And I got interested, you know, okay, I wanted to do a pilot for another show. I had a show called Global Business 2000, and I wanted to call it Conspiracy, and each show would consist of three stories, and the middle one was one that, you know, you might buy. And the story I set out to shoot for the pilot was the Barry Seal story in Louisiana. And instead of being a 15-minute a bit on a half-an-hour pilot, it turned into like 2 years of my life.
For my listeners that may be unfamiliar, who was Barry Seal?
The most famous American drug smuggler in history, who I discovered in my book Barry and the Boys and a couple documentaries, had been a lifelong CIA pilot. Hmm. Which, you know, kind of says it all, dude, okay? That's the big dirty secret they don't want you to know about. I don't really care about any. Yeah, I mean, I care about the same things you do because I'm a human being. But when it comes right down to it, the only thing that matters is where the money is coming from. Mm-hmm. And if it keeps coming into the same hands, nothing changes. Because why would it?
Well, yeah, I was going to say, they just did that movie, that Tom Cruise movie, American Made. I've heard from you that it's not exactly an accurate portrayal.
It's a piece of fiction, but the interesting thing about it is that it didn't happen by accident. The guy that made the film actually makes science fiction movies, and I've liked a few of them. He's generally conceded to be the biggest jerk in Hollywood, and that's putting it mildly. But that's all I knew about him until I found out later that his father, had been the majority counsel for the John Kerry Commission hearings into Iran-Contra.
Wow.
And, yeah, dude. Whatever you think of John Kerry, I mean, you know, it doesn't matter. But, the weight of opinion afterwards is that the investigation into Iran-Contra had been thwarted, had been shut down. Okay, so they never heard evidence about the cocaine smuggling, which was what it was all about. And so this director's dad had to be part of the cover-up. Had to be. Has to be. He's dead now.
You know, I did not know that about the people involved in the American Made movie. It sounds like they wouldn't have been on the side of a journalist like Gary Webb, who was one of the first people to cover the Iran-Contra cocaine connection. And he got just pounced on for it very unfairly.
Well, that's what got me political again. Mm-hmm. I got very upset by 1998 that this guy, a reporter at the San Jose Mercury News, and a good reporter at that, had done what should have been a Pulitzer Prize winning series proving that the CIA had allowed the Contras to sell cocaine in order to fund their little war. And for his pains, he was run out of journalism. He lost his job, he lost his wife, lost his house. And on the night before he killed himself, he was thinking about losing the next day because they were coming to repossess it. the one thing he had left that he cared about, which was his motorcycle. Now, if that isn't about the saddest damn story you've ever heard, I mean, it was to me. It still is, as I tell it to you. I mean, that poor guy, and he never knew. He never knew that his death has inspired literally 100 guys like me.
I mean, we have a whole movie based on him now, a Hollywood movie, Kill the Messenger. I mean, there's so many people that were inspired by Gary Webb and his Dark Alliance series. It's really a masterwork.
Yeah, it is. It is. So when that all happened, I got upset, and I was already down in Louisiana investigating Barry Seal, who was a lifelong CIA pilot. I mean, it just and here's the thing, dude. Before I got to Louisiana, there had already been four bestsellers written about Barry Seal. And not one of them had mentioned his lifelong connection with the CIA. This guy started flying for the CIA when he was 15 years old. He flew weapons. Before he was 20, he was flying weapons into the mountains of Cuba for Fidel Castro, because get this, the CIA supported Castro before they turned against him. I learned a lot about, you know, the history of my life, my generation, just by poking into his.
And that was for the documentary, right, that you were working on?
I did a book, Barry and the Boys. I did two documentaries, The Secret Heartbeat of America and In Search of the American Drug Lords. Imagine that. And that's my gig, dude. The American Drug Lords. Hello. How come we don't know who they are? You know? Every poor slob in Mexico, excuse me, not poor slob, every journalist in Mexico living in fear for his life knows who the drug lords are in Mexico, in his own country. And here we are in the U.S., supposedly a much freer country, and we don't know who ours are. And that's the part of fake news that... that's really fake. I mean, when I got, I wrote a book about Muhammad Atta.
The 9/11 hijacker.
That's right, the 9/11 hijacker. For those of you tuning in late. And I did that book because, well, it was happenstance, at least partly. My parents retired to Florida in the 80s. Okay, and I spent my career out in Los Angeles, and I would fly home, you know, once a winter or every other year to see my mom and dad, you know, catch up with the family. And they lived in Venice, Florida. They retired in Venice, Florida, where three of the four terrorist hijackers learned to fly, or supposedly learned to fly. So when 9/11 happened, I was waiting for Barry and the Boys to come out, and two things happened at once. Number one, it turned out that three of the four terrorist pilots learned to fly in Venice, a place with which I had some familiarity. And the other thing was I had already developed over the last 2-3 years an unintended expertise in state-sponsored aviation crime. Or state-sponsored crime involving aviation, because state-sponsored crime often involves aviation. Are you with me?
Yeah, I'm following. Go on.
What do you want to know? You're interested in, so I follow drug smuggling, okay? And when... was reported was 6 weeks ago, almost 2 months ago, that a container ship had been busted in Philadelphia carrying 19 tons of cocaine. It's like the second biggest bust in U.S. history.
And you've written about this before, too, with the DC-9 jets carrying cocaine. There's been multiple incidents of this.
Yes. Yeah, that's here's something a U.S. Customs agent in Louisiana told me early on that really has kind of resonated since. I was surprised to find out that one player knew this other player because they were, like, in different realms. And he said, you know, that's, like, kind of pretty naive. He says, there's not a lot of players out there. They all pretty much know each other. And so what I lucked into, really, with Barry Seal was the main line. And so all I have to do is follow people that were in business with Barry Seal when he was smuggling, $5 billion worth of cocaine in the early 80s to catch up with what's happening in the world today. Okay? I mean, and that's a true story.
Well, I was going to say real quick, one of the reasons I've been very interested in your work is, I'm really interested in this topic of narco-capitalism. It seems like we live in a narco world, or as you've put it, a gangster planet. I think of the journalist Robert Saviano. He wrote a really interesting book called 000, and I love the subtitle. It's called, the subtitle is, "Look at Cocaine and All You See is Powder. Look through cocaine and you see the world." And I think in a way your work sort of gets at that, you know, that we live in this world where, you know, narcotics is big business and it ties into everything from banking to politics.
You are correct, sir. You are correct. And thanks for liking my work. I mean, when I hear from somebody that hey, I've been reading your stuff, I like your stuff. That's kind of like, I guess, what I live for, because they don't make it very remunerative to do what I'm doing. So cool. Yeah, I mean, this is the main line. This is what it's about. This is the big slush fund they fight over every 4 years, seemingly. I'll tell you how the drugs were described to me. Okay. Because, and here's a little historical note, because you may probably don't remember, cocaine became very fashionable in the early 1980s, and cocaine, there was a huge market for it, and it was very soon, a multi-billion dollar market, and that's when it exploded. And I talked to, actually befriended, a guy who had spent, 30, 40 years working at either the CIA or the NSA or maybe both, who had told me he was retired. He actually wasn't, but it was okay. He was an older guy, and I made sure he liked me, because I didn't want anything. I didn't want anything rash to happen that wasn't supposed to. And here's how he explained it to me. And he goes back to the 50s, okay? Congress wants more intelligence from the CIA than it's willing to pay for. And so if you had an informant, for example, who, was telling you all about the government of Turkey, but he also happened to be kind of a heroin smoker, well, you just might, close your eyes. He said, then cocaine came along, he said, and that's when drugs became the tail that wagged the dog.
Well, that certainly seems to be the case. It's something that has always bothered me when people talk about the war on drugs. Because to me, I'm like, how can you even have a war on drugs when it makes $500 billion in the global economy annually? In other words, it's big business. I don't even know how you can have a war on drugs when it's so enmeshed in the global economic system at this point.
Well, that's when you realize that the media is controlled, okay? When I got down to Venice, Florida, after 3 months after 9/11, where three of the four terrorist pilots had learned to fly, I mean, I realized that Venice, Florida, was the biggest September 11th crime scene that hadn't been reduced to rubble. And when I got down there 3 months after 9/11, there wasn't anybody here. It wasn't a guy. I wasn't having to step over Bob Woodward to get to the bar. Okay? And what struck me as strange was, you know, it wasn't as if, like, this aspect of the story was ignored by the national press, except for, like, one guy in Seattle and, you know, somebody from the Minneapolis-St. Paul area. It wasn't like that. There was nobody. There was nobody. And that's when I realized, ooh. And that was spooky for a while, because there were times there when I had information which, if it had been widely public, might have changed a few people's minds about what we were doing.
Well, I wanted to go in there real quick. A lot of people may not realize this, but your work is cited very briefly in one of the main sort of journalistic efforts on 9/11, a book by Anthony Summers, which, you know, I think it says a lot about your work that you've been mentioned in that context.
How did you know that?
I've read the Summers book.
Yeah, but it's only in a footnote, dude. I'm serious. I'm going to tell you my Anthony Summers. I can't believe you're obviously well read. I mean, can you swear on podcasts, can't you?
Yeah, no problem, man.
Well, fuck me. Anthony Summers was one of the biggest disappointments of my life. He spent a month here with me in Venice. I showed him around on three separate trips, and he reported nothing of what I showed him. Zero. Zero, 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 zero. And I introduced him to people that told him the same stories that I had reported. I introduced him to the wife of a Maytag repairman who lived right next door. She and her husband in the apartment next door with Muhammad Atta and his stripper girlfriend, American stripper girlfriend, for 6 weeks. And he reported none of that. I mean, yeah. Does it get any more prosaic than the wife of a Maytag repairman? Okay? If you can't believe the wives of Maytag repairmen, you know, who can you believe? I also took him to see my local pharmacist. The local pharmacist here, in case of what I can give, was the same guy my dad had used for 20 years before he died. I knew this guy. And I had been down here for almost a year before he told me, you know, he said to me, you know, they used to come in here. And then I wormed the story out of him. And Muhammad Atta and Marwan al-Shehi had come into Barclays Pharmacy a few times, but the time that stuck in his mind was they came in 10 days before 9/11 with Muhammad Atta's father. Okay? His dad, which, as we all learned after 9/11, his dad didn't even believe he was dead. And so if his dad, I don't know, forget whose dad was, some sort of professor in Egypt, if his dad was part of the plot, then it was much bigger than, but the, and he had videotape of it. I know I'm forced to tell you this story now. He had videotape of it, you know, because pharmacists record everything that goes on in front of them, and he offered to give me the videotape, and I took it, 30 hours the week, the whole week. And I don't know if you ever watched security footage before, but it's like, you know, the most boring thing you'll ever do. It just flickers by day by day by day. And I watched, you know, 4 hours of, you know, it was 4 hours long. I watched it three separate times and never saw Muhammad Atta. And I said, well, I'm going to give this one more time. Because he had called the FBI to tell him right after 9/11. Hey, they were here. And he gave them the tape. And they brought it back to him later, you know, I guess months later, and said, nothing there. Nothing there. And so he just put the tape away. He didn't, you know. So I watched this videotape three times and could see nothing. So I'm going to give it one last try and sit down and do it. And I watched it slower than I watched it before, and there was a whole day missing. Just snipped right the fuck out of a half-inch videotape. So obviously they transfer it from a half-inch videotape to something else and then transferred it back. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was pretty... I found that, you know? I mean, I did that. So Anthony Summers can kiss my ass. You know, there's a lot of guys, and he was perfectly charming. I don't want to... but he's one of them. I'm clearly one of them. There's a lot of guys who make their reputation with like one really good early book, and then they spend the rest of their career cashing in on it. I mean, he did books on Sinatra and Marilyn Monroe. What else did he do? I mean,
JFK.
He didn't do JFK. He wrote a book called Conspiracy.
Mm-hmm.
You talking about Anthony Summers?
Yeah, I thought he did a book on JFK. I could be wrong about that.
Okay, right. I thought you were saying the title JFK. He did do a book on JFK, and that is what his reputation rests on.
Mm-hmm. Well, in relation to 9/11, just to clear it up for my listeners, in Venice, Florida, that's where the hijackers, including Muhammad Atta, went to a flight school there. And interestingly enough, years later, the man who I believe purchased that flight school, Rudy Deckers, was implicated in a cocaine smuggling scandal.
Yeah, how about that? I mean, that's...
That's on the record. That's not like some just an out-of-nowhere conspiracy theory, folks.
Well, no. What's also on the record is the major thing I found out in Florida, which has been reported, but not been reported. 3 weeks after Atta and Marwan al-Sheikhi arrived to attend Huffman Aviation in Venice, the owner's Learjet was busted on a runway at Orlando Executive Airport by DEA agents with submachine guns who found 43 pounds of heroin on board.
Wow.
Yeah, and... You mean you know about footnotes in Anthony Summers' book, but you didn't know that? let me get your copy of Welcome to Terrorland, my second book. Just be sure to zip me an address, and I'll send you one.
Maybe bringing this forward a little bit, you're currently working on a book called Gangster Planet. Maybe you could outline what the major thesis of Gangster Planet is for people that may... be a little confused right now. I hope they're not. I think we've sort of hashed out and gone in a sort of direction here.
Well, what would you think Gangster Planet is? Let me ask you, JG, what do you think? What do you think about our Gangster Planet? You know, I mean, look at what's happened in the last few years. Mm-hmm. And it's drug money. It's drug money, okay? Here's the deal. The UN guy in charge of drug trafficking in 2011 released a report, and he stated right there that if it hadn't been for drug money, the major banks on Wall Street would have gone under. The only liquidity in our economy in 2008 was drug money. Wow.
Well, that explains this 19 tons of cocaine that were found on a container ship at the port of Philadelphia just a few weeks ago. I mean, Washington Post and Associated Press were both writing about it and pointing the finger at Mediterranean Shipping Company.
Well, that's a good way to point it. I mean, there's other ways to point it, too. But 19 tons of cocaine represents, like, a statement of some kind. Okay. For example, when Wally Hilliard's Learjet was found with 43 pounds of heroin, I asked somebody, you know, about it, and he said, he described 43 pounds is what's known in the trade, he said, as heavy weight. Okay? Nobody ever, like, just comes across 43 pounds of heroin by accident. Okay, so 19 tons of cocaine, that's heavy weight. I mean, that's an industrial. First of all, there's no point. Why would you ever, I mean, there are a million ways to smuggle drugs on a million different days. I mean, 19 tons at once. What was the point? And it was hot in Europe this summer. It's been hot. Maybe people are doing more cocaine, you know, but that can't be it. Actually, you can trace it back. I mean, I did trace it back. I know who owned the cocaine. It's the Russian mob. And so clearly, the fact that the government and law enforcement won't release that fact says a lot.
Well, I was going to say, in regards to the Russian mob, I wanted to ask you about this because you were the first person I came across who noted connections between our current president, Donald Trump, and the Russian mob. I believe you were one of the first persons I heard to speak about this character of Semyon Mogilevich, which a few people in the mainstream media are talking about now, but really that aspect of the Russia Gate story is not really talked about. Maybe you could tell my listeners a little bit about Semyon Mogilevich and how he fits into the stories you've been covering. A man who, for the benefit of my listeners, has been described as being at the very center of the Vorevye Sokonya, or the thieves in law, that is to say, the criminal elite of the Russian mafia.
Well, I will let someone else tell you about Semyon Mogilevich. Well, I do know about Semyon Mogilevich, but it's a longer story than maybe you want to hear. Here's how, telling you how I found out about it probably, you know, explains it best, right? Wally Hilliard had a pilot flying for him named Michael Francis Brassington, who was the son of a prominent family in Guyana in South America. And Michael Francis Brassington went on, he was the co-pilot on the heroin Learjet, and he went on to have an infamous career getting all kinds of trouble all over the Caribbean. Drug trafficking is what he was doing. He became the personal pilot. This is a good story. It's a funny story. He became the personal pilot to the premier of the Turks and Caicos, whose name escapes me at the moment, but he was married. He had just married a prominent black actress in Hollywood, Lisa somebody, okay? And she's, from her testimony, when they got divorced a year later, from her testimony is where we learn what was going on. Michael Misick, that's his name. Michael Misick, he was the premier. Michael told, trying to impress his new Hollywood girlfriend, told her that when he became premier, when she met him, he was worth $40,000. And 2 years later, or was it 3 years later, 2 or 3 years later, he was worth $120 million.
Wow.
Yeah. True story. I mean, she's Lisa Ray. Lisa Ray somebody. Anyway, a TV actress who's on some, you know, but that's how, you know, you could read about what she was saying, you know. Lisa Ray and Michael have a spat, you know. And so there you go. And Michael Francis Brassington, Wally Hilliard's pilot, was his personal pilot, okay? And then Hilliard flies a jet into the ground, and you know, the government finally takes notice. Well, what was going on behind the scenes that it took me a while to figure out was that his family, who was like the prominent family in Guyana, his dad, who had the cushiest job in the government, was the minister for privatization in Guyana, and cut a billion-dollar deal, or supposedly, press releases came out, did a $1 billion deal to put in an aluminum bauxite plant in Guyana. We did the deal with Oleg Deripaska, the Russian oligarch, whose name you first heard because he was paying Paul Manafort, Trump's campaign manager, like $10 million a year. So it looks to me as if Oleg Deripaska is in the drug business, because he's in business with a family who's got a drug pilot, you know, God knows what else they're doing. So I'm paying attention to Oleg Deripaska. And you can look this up, dude, okay? I mean, you've just said, you know, as I've listened to you, like, talk about the number of, like, of firsts that I've dug out, I'm kind of patting myself on the back, and it's like, that's a bunch of them. But, and here's another. So when it was briefly a kerfuffle in 2008, when Donald Trump sold a mansion in Palm Beach to a Russian billionaire slash mobster who controlled the Russian fertilizer industry the way Oleg Deripaska controlled the Russian aluminum industry, I thought to myself, I'll bet you fertilizer's got something to do with aluminum. Turns out it does. The common denominator is potash. Don't ask me what potash is. I have no friggin' idea. But that's a true story. So I thought, I better pay attention to this a little bit. And I did. I wrote a story about it. In 2008, I mean, this is 10 years, or 8 years before the 2016 election. And I gave it a cute title. It was a headline. Trump sells mansion to mobsters sans frontier, like doctors without frontiers, mobsters without frontiers. So there, I mean, and then Russian mobsters came back into my life after all of this. I'm also tracking, two drug moves out of you know, when things go wrong, that's when you like learn what's going on, because when things go right, you don't hear a word about it. There were two planes, American planes, from St. Petersburg that got busted in Mexico, 18 months apart. One had 5.5 tons of cocaine, the second one had 4 tons of cocaine. And they were connected. Okay, they were connected, and their ownership, if you looked at the registration of these two planes, okay, and go back like, you know, 3-4 owners, they had both been owned by the same people. So, you knew they were connected. So, I'm paying attention to guys who were involved with these two planes. And a couple of them are in Sarasota. One of them is a guy, one of them works for Steve Bannon.
Really?
One of them was Steve Bannon's top lieutenant. Guy by the name of Andy Bottolato. Lives not 30 minutes from where I'm sitting right now. Andy Bottolato was Steve Bannon's top lieutenant, was planning on working in the White House before the scandal hit. And Andy Bottolato is a serial financial fraudster. Okay, these guys have learned that there's a soft spots where they can commit crime with virtual impunity. Okay, and one of them is financial crime. Okay, I mean pump and dump. You can make a couple $100 million and hardly anybody knows. You know, I mean, it's like a minor local scandal. And that's what this guy does. Worked for Steve Bannon, was involved, okay, and he was involved. He had two partners I'm going to talk about. One of them, right there in Sarasota, is another financial fraudster who's living in Costa Rica, and he has a phony brokerage down there that is pretending to own the DC-9 that got busted with 5.5 tons of cocaine, which was an Adnan Khashoggi deal, by the way.
Adnan Khashoggi, for my listeners, is probably the most notorious international international arms dealer in 20th century history.
There you go. And arms always appear, almost always, apparently, with drugs.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of the people, apparently, I mean, a lot of the people, what do we do? Okay, we sell guns. I mean, we're weapons. I mean, that's our biggest export. And a lot of the people that we sell guns to can't afford to pay for them. But they can pay in kind. They can pay in drugs. And apparently that's a deal that happens quite, or oil. That's a deal that happens quite often. Yeah, that's Adnan Khashoggi. Okay, so, I mean, we're already into high cotton here, right? I assume you can follow me because you read the footnotes in Anthony Summers' book, which was boring. It was. You know what? And this is the thing I'll never forgive him for, okay? He had the last chance, because there had already been like half dozen books written about 9/11. You know, two or three major offerings, and you knew his book was going to be the last one.
Mm-hmm.
And he just failed the test completely. Completely. And that's sad. It's sad for all of us.
Well, not to go off topic, but it's interesting that you mentioned Bannon, because, you know, for a second I was surprised, and then I remembered, you know, Bannon's Florida house, they found a meth lab in it. I mean, drugs seem to be everywhere in these political and crime circles. It's amazing.
You know, he's an interesting guy. I mean, he's the one guy I wouldn't mind meeting, because I've read both of Michael Wolff's books now, and what Bannon said made a lot of sense. I mean, the first big quote that came out when Wolf's book came out was from Bannon. It was like, oh my God, now they're going to find out about this, about that. They're going to find out about the money laundering. Okay? And ba-bing. That's what the scandal is about. The scandal is about money laundering. He was involved Okay, but here's the interesting point. You want to hear about Semyon Mogilevich? That's how I say it. I have no idea how he pronounces his own name, and that's the problem with these guys from foreign countries. Is they fool us by spelling their last name like half dozen different ways. So, Andy Bottolato is involved. Is in business with another Sarasota fraudster named Jonathan Kershen, and Jonathan Gershon is supplying paperwork to the shareholders in the company that owns the DC-9, gets busted with 5.5 tons of cocaine. You with me? All right. Jonathan Gershon, I find out, was involved 15 years ago, 1994, or 15 years from when I found out, in an effort to pull Semyon Mogilevich's bacon out of the fire in Toronto. And so this is where I found out that Mogilevich, his first major incursion before he retreated, was he got a company that made magnets registered on the Toronto Stock Exchange by buying a company that made magnets somewhere in Canada, you know, and but then the company stopped making magnets as soon as he'd consolidated, because now what he wanted to use it for was like some major fraud on the Toronto Stock Exchange. And the government stepped in and shut him down. They were about to seize the company when this guy, Jonathan Gershon, stepped in and said, I'll buy it and take it private. Asserting that he was the owner of an insurance company in Sarasota, Florida. Well, you or I could be the owner of an insurance company in Sarasota, Florida. You know, Parallax Insurance. By the way, Parallax, did you ever see the movie Parallax? You must have saw Parallax View.
Warren Beatty, yes.
That was a great movie, dude. There were a couple movies made, Executive Action, Parallax View, maybe one other. Mm-hmm. They were really pretty close to the truth. And this was close enough after the Kennedy assassination, so you went, woo. Yeah, Parallax View, pretty good movie about the Kennedy assassination. So, this guy, Jonathan Gershon, who's involved with moving 5.5 tons of cocaine with Adnan Khashoggi in 2006, 12 years earlier, had been working with Semyon Mogilevich.
The boss of bosses, as he's known in Russia.
The boss, yes. That's what they say, okay? That's what they say. So, now listen to where the story goes. Adnan Khashoggi, at the time that he was a brilliant guy. Yeah, he would be an interesting guy to have met, because he was doing three things at once with one company. He was busting it out. He was using it in drug trafficking. One other thing I'm going to miss, but right at the moment. But Khashoggi had a subsidiary in 2003-2004 called Blue Moon Group. It was a record company. And it was owned by a really hapless Tampa mobster named Mike, what's his last name? It'll come to me in a second. But here's the thing. In 2003 and 2004, Blue Moon Group shared a house with and worked with a Russian company owned by the man whose name I first heard the FBI use as having participated in hacking the 2016 election. Pavel Vrublevsky, Russia's Uber hacker, was in the U.S. in 2003-2004 working with this Tampa mob dude. And what he was doing was Vrublevsky, the Russians are very mathematically minded, and so they're ahead of us in hacking, apparently. And this guy had already established a PayPal-like company to process, and who he could get, who used him to process their web sales were mob porn sites, and that's what they were running in Howard's Beach, Florida, in 2003. So the Russian mob, I mean, you know, the idea that the Russian mob was in business with the U.S. mob here in the U.S., I mean, that's been known. But this is like the major Russian hacker. Now, you think I've been able to get that out? I mean, you know, all of this stuff I find out is like, you know, is earth-shaking news.
And it's hidden in plain sight a lot of times.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't have to be the world's smartest guy to figure it out.
Well, so out of curiosity, when it comes to Russiagate, I think a lot of people look at it as being about Putin. But mm-hmm. I feel like it's more about a sort of what I think you've referred to as transnational organized crime, which is being basically protected at this point.
Yeah, which is the really scary thing. I think the forces of transnational organized crime right at this moment are more powerful than any single sovereign entity, mm-hmm. including the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Well, I was going to say it's the reason why we can't win a war on drugs. I feel like, you know, if we tried to end it, you would find out that the people that would push against ending it would probably have connections to organized crime and drug running.
The people that want the war on drugs to continue
mm-hmm.
are the same people that supply the drugs. What selling an illegal substance does is increase the prices six times. So a shot of whiskey that cost $1 the day before prohibition started cost $2 the next day. And they figure that's the same thing with drugs. Or it costs $6. So that is the force multiplier that makes being in the drug business so powerfully lucrative, the massive amounts of money. While in terms of foreign trade, you know, it's probably like right up there with the biggest businesses in the world, but in terms of profit, it's got to be number one all by itself, with the number one with a bullet. Okay. I recently read this, but I've had read it before. More than 50% of the profit from organized crime comes from drugs.
Mm-hmm.
So you line up everything that organized crime is into, extortion, money laundering, protection, what all they do, gambling, loan sharking, make a list. And all those things don't add up to as much as they make from drugs.
And, you know, a lot of these cartels are connected to big banks at this point and offshore banks. I mean, it's really frightening when you think about it.
It is what it is. I mean, yeah. This is the deep structure of our society.
It's the heartbeat of the system in a lot of ways.
That's right. The secret heartbeat of America. I did a documentary called The Secret Heartbeat of America. And I've gone from The Secret Heartbeat of America to Gangster Planet. Yeah, so there's a thread there somewhere.
Well, maybe before you go, I wanted to ask you real quickly, because on this show we've covered the Jeffrey Epstein scandal a lot, and you've referred to Jeffrey Epstein as a meta scandal. Maybe real briefly, you could sort of lay out why you call it a meta scandal, and then we can wrap up by directing listeners to your website.
That sounds like a plan to me. Jeffrey Epstein's Little Black Book. Versus the 19 tons of cocaine found on a container ship in Philadelphia. Is there a connection between the two? Well, it turns out there is. So far, the highest ranking person that they've managed to arrest was the ship's second mate. And you don't imagine that his credit extended, you know, to like, you know, letting some cartel, you know, front him 19 tons of cocaine. Then you look at Jeffrey Epstein's little black book and you go, hey, I'll bet who owned that 19 tons of cocaine is in that little black book.
It's a book of all his contacts, for my listeners that may be unfamiliar. Yeah.
Well, yeah. Which is when you realize that it's the elite that's operating with impunity, that's running drugs. So, but it goes beyond there. I mean, I who did I find in Epstein's? Oh, Adnan Khashoggi, dude. Adnan Khashoggi and Jeffrey Epstein and Donald Trump are the Palm Beach homies. Okay? They attended each other's weddings, went to parties together. So, so, you know, but you have to ask yourself, what's really going on? It's really hard to say. I mean, nobody's going to tell you. Why did that 19 tons of cocaine get busted? Most of the time, I have found, in major drug busts happen by accident or by mistake. Okay? But there's a reason that the 19 tons got busted, and I think what it is because there's a war going on between these two Serbian mafia clans in Kotor, Montenegro, which is where the sailors came from. And so one of the clans is snitching out the other one. And they've been in this war for like 3-4 years, and there have been like, you know, 50-100 deaths in Europe, all over Europe because of it. So you would think if, like, you know, if you're trying to, like, that you would have an idea that the other group could possibly snitch you out, and you wouldn't send 19 tons at once. But that apparently is what happened. And I have to wonder if some of the money from those drugs wouldn't have somehow wormed its way into Donald Trump's reelection campaign. So, without being able to prove it, that's what, because there's no other explanation I have come up with or heard that explains the magnitude of that move. 19 tons. There's something emphatic, there's something desperate, there's something about moving, you know, 19 tons that is so out of the ordinary as to call attention to itself. So, that's all I know, boss. Oh, I got one more thing to tell you, and then you tell them about my website, and then I gotta go. I know who QAnon is.
Oh, really?
I was just leafing through your list of shows. I would bet money that I'm absolutely right. You want to hear who it is?
I mean, go right ahead, Daniel.
It's Jerome Corsi.
The right-wing sort of propagandist.
Yes. But don't sell him short. Jerome Corsi is the man that kept John Kerry from becoming president of the United States in 2004 with the Swift boat business. And Jerome Corsi is the guy that was behind the whole birther thing that Trump eventually bought into. Jerome Corsi is a disinformation specialist par excellence. And Jerome Corsi stole a bunch of money from people he was in the stock market business and took a bunch of money from people in a deal a deal that was supposedly going to happen in Poland, and none of them got the money back. So my money is on Jerome Corsi has pulled off two major coups. You know, he swift boated John Kerry, and he started that whole birther business. That's Jerome Corsi. So who would you suspect could be QAnon might be someone who's done it before.
And someone who is a big supporter of this QAnon conspiracy.
Is that right? Jerome Corsi is? You know, see if you can get a picture of the two of them together in a room at the same time. Okay? So, tell them about my website. I'm gonna get off the call because I'm hoarse and I've got to get some water here. But I've enjoyed talking to you. You're a very smart guy, and you know a lot of stuff. Believe me, dude, you do. So I'm impressed. So send me a link when this goes up, and I'll send it out to everyone that's interested. Okay?
Sounds great. Hopefully I can have you on sometime in the future again. I appreciate it.
Good to talk to you. Take care.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you found my conversation with Daniel Hopsicker both enjoyable and intriguing. Daniel threw a bit of a unexpected but ultimately welcome curveball at me when he gave his take on who is behind QAnon near the end of our conversation. Kind of blew my mind. I had never considered that right-wing propagandist Jerome Corsi, who's been behind everything from birtherism to boosting the QAnon conspiracy theory, could be Q himself. I'm slapping myself over the head because it's actually possibly the most probable player. I'm kind of dumbfounded that I hadn't considered Jerome Corsi as the sort of mastermind behind the QAnon sense, so to speak. Anyways, I highly recommend checking out Daniel Hopsicker's website, madcowprod.com. That's madcowprod.com. You don't have to agree with everything Daniel says, but I think there are some rather tasty morsels and food for thought in his work. Update for my Patreon listeners. I'm starting production on Patreon episodes once again. We just had a previously unpublished conversation with former Roger Stone collaborator Robert Morrow put up on the Patreon feed. Additionally, we may soon be starting production on a Parallax Views current events show, provided I can work things out with my potential co-host. So lots to look forward to for listeners of Parallax Views in the near future. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say, don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxieties, problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight. with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.